Happy Sabbath to everyone. Welcome everybody first. Around the world, right? Maybe it's Sabbath on the other side. So happy Sabbath to everyone. Sabbath morning in the Philippines. Oh, they're in the Philippines too? So happy Sabbath out there in the Philippines. What page would you like to start? Suggestion. Any suggestion? I can't see. Page what?
Page 4.
Okay, shall we start on that? Page 4. Live out the life within me. Okay.
Live out the life within me, O Jesus, King of Kings. Be thou thyself the answer to all my Christian needs. Live out thy life within me, in all things of thy way. By the transparent medium, thy glory to display. The temple has been yielded and purified of sin. Let thy Shekinah glory now shine forth from within. And all the keep silence, the body in sport be. Thy silent, gentle servant, move on me as by thee. Its members every moment held subject to thy call. Ready to have the use that are not be used at all. Filled with a restless longing, or strain, or stress, or fret, or chappings and idealings, or thoughts of vain regret. But restful, calm, and client, from bend and bias free, awaiting thy decision when thou hast need of me. Leave a dialogue within me, O Jesus, King of Kings. Be thou the glorious answer to all my Christian needs.
Another one? Any favorite ones? What page? Page 9, O Brother, Be Faithful. O Brother, Be Faithful, Son Jesus will come. For whom we have waited so long. O Son, we shall enter our glorious home and join in the conqueror's song.
Oh, brother, be faithful. Why should we prove unfaithful to him who has shown to join in the conqueror's
song? Oh, it's on the left side.
Oh, brother, be faithful, the city of gold. Prepare for the good and the blessed. It's waiting, it's for toss of pearl to unfold. And welcome thee into thy rest. Then, brother, for faithful not long shall we stay. Unfaithful and time's dark nights of sorrow is wearing away. We haste to thy glorious morn. Oh, brother, be faithful, his son will descend. Creation omnipotent King. But legions of angels his chariots attend. And palm wreaths of victory bring. Oh, brother, be faithful and son, shalt thou hear thy Savior pronounce the glad word. Well done, faithful servant, thy title is clear to enter the joy of thy Lord. Oh, brother, be faithful, eternity's years shall tell for thy faithfulness now. When bright smiles of gladness shall scatter thy tears, a coronet gleam on thy brow. Oh, brother, be faithful, the promise is sure that waits for the faithful and tried. To reign with a ransom immortal and pure, and ever with Jesus above.
Amen. Another one. 19. This is almost time.
Tis almost time for the Lord to come. I hear the people say, the stars of heaven are growing dim. It must be the breaking of the day. Oh, it must be the breaking of the day. Oh, it must be the breaking of the day. The night is almost gone, the day is coming close. Oh, it must be the breaking of the day. The signs foretold in the sun and moon, and earth and sea and sky, aloud proclaim to all mankind, the coming of the Master groweth nigh. Oh, it must be the breaking of day. Oh, it must be the breaking of the day.
The night is almost gone, the day is coming. Oh, it must be the breaking of the day. It must be the waiting church to cast her bride away. With girded loins and burning lamps to look for the breaking of the day. Oh, it must be the breaking of the day. Oh, it must be the breaking of the day. The night is almost gone, the day is coming on. Oh, it must be the breaking of the day. Go quickly out in the streets and lanes and in the broad highway and call the maimed, the halt and blind to be ready for the breaking of the day. Oh, it must be the breaking of the day. Oh, it must be the breaking of the day. The night is almost gone, the day is coming on. Oh, it must be the breaking of the day.
Opening song. Okay. We're gonna have our opening song. Well, page one, right? Okay, shall we all stand? Those are able to please stand.
Look for the way marks as she journey on. Look for the way marks passing one by one. Down through the ages, past the kingdoms four. Where are we standing? Look the way marks o'er. Look for the way marks, the great prophetic way marks. Down through the ages, past the kingdoms four. Look for the way marks, the great prophetic way marks. The journey's almost o'er. First the Assyrian kingdom ruled the world. Then mid of Persia banners were unfurled. And after Greece held universal sway, Rome seized the scepter where are we today. Look for the way marks, the great prophetic way marks, down through the ages, past the kingdoms four. Look for the way marks, the great prophetic way marks, the journey's almost o'er. Down in the feet of iron and of clay, weak and divided, soon to pass away. What will the next great glorious drama be? Christ and his coming and eternity. Look for the way marks, the great prophetic way marks, down through the ages, past the kingdoms four. Look for the way marks, the great prophetic way marks, the journey's almost over.
Thank you, Israel. Happy Sabbath, everyone. I'd like to welcome everyone that's here, everyone that is online, everyone that is listening on the phone and over the radio. Hopefully we'll have a big crowd this time. Just a few words of introduction. My name is Jenny. My husband Rick and I were the ones responsible for putting together this series that we are going to be doing this weekend. We're going to be covering a lot of material very fast. A lot of you have seen this material before. Some have not. If you haven't, you will probably want to see it more than once because you're going to miss parts of this. There is an enormous amount of material we're going to cover. For a little bit of background, I was born Seventh-day Adventist, raised Seventh-day Adventist, very conservative Seventh-day Adventist, I might add, third generation. My grandfather, William Craig, who was a well-known orthopedic surgeon in Loma Linda, California, was born into a Seventh-day Adventist family in Santa Rosa, California in 1915. His parents became Seventh-day Adventists through the labors of none other than John Loughborough. And I remember when I was a little girl, my grandfather talking about John Loughborough with enormous respect and almost reverence. He loved John Loughborough. So that has sort of carried over to me a little bit. I always get a warm feeling when I hear the name John Loughborough because, you know, he had something to do with my family finding the truth. When I was 9, I discovered books. And I don't think I have been without at least one and usually 2 or 3 books that I'm in the process of reading since that time. When I was 15, Brother Gary gave me a book that I had never seen before. Brother Gary Kane. And actually, he gave one to each member of our family. It was the Book of Daniel by Stephen Haskell. I had never even heard of Stephen Haskell before that time. And I sat down and I read that book. In fact, our whole family read the book together in worship as well. And we looked up every single Bible text in the margin. And my mom read the book. And we loved it. There were things in that book that we had never heard in the church. So we got down to Daniel 11, and I clearly remember this. My mom was reading ahead, and she got to Daniel 11:45, and she came and she talked to me. She and I were really close. We were always talking about everything. And she says, "This doesn't make any sense whatsoever. What is he talking about? Turkey? Turkey coming to its end just before Christ comes? This doesn't make any sense." She says, "Turkey doesn't have any significance in world events today, whatever." And I agreed. I said, "I have no idea what he's talking about." We knew nothing about the history of the Ottoman Empire at that time. We did not know the history of what was going on in the newspapers at the time when Haskell was writing, which was 1905. We left it as a big question mark because we didn't know. And what we looked up at the time, we didn't have the internet at that point, didn't help us any. I think in my life, I have heard prior to doing this study that we're presenting, probably 2 sermons from Adventists on the King of the North. The first one, I can't even remember what his position was. The second one was that it wasn't the Ottoman Empire, it was Islam that was going to fulfill verse 45. I don't remember hearing any other sermons. I didn't know anybody was researching it. 5 years ago, we started looking at it. And it has changed our lives. I am not the same person I was 5 years ago, and it's because of this study, and this is why we're going to share with you what we have found. My husband, Rick, comes from a different background than I do. His parents were Adventists, but from the age of 5 on, there was no religious training in his family. His grandparents were Adventists. They basically bounced from the Adventist church to the Reformed church and back again. But he had no exposure to the spirit of prophecy, hardly any exposure to the Bible, and went to public school. At the age of 17, he had a almost death experience. He met the Lord, and he started reading. His grandmother gave him The Great Controversy, and he read it all the way through, and he got every spirit of prophecy book he could find, and he spent the next 5 years reading, doing almost nothing but reading, and he read himself into the truth. So with these two perspectives, mine coming from very conservative Adventists, grew up reading the spirit of prophecy, his coming from almost completely outside, has given us a unique viewpoint to be able to do the research that we've done. What you're going to see this weekend is different from anything you have ever seen before on this prophecy. But we're basing it solidly on what Ellen White, James White, Uriah Smith, and Stephen Haskell preached in the 1800s, and we're going to prove it to you. This series has 10 parts. It can basically be broken into 3 sections. Parts 1 through 3 is the first section. They are dealing with the history of the SDA Church and its teachings on this topic. The reason this is important is because what you have been told in the church about what the pioneers taught on this topic is a lie. And we're going to prove that to you. We didn't know it was a lie when we started this. We were very shocked when we found what they actually wrote. The second section is 4 parts, and it deals with the prophecy itself and the history that fulfills it. The third section is the most important. It's the last 3 parts. And those last 3 parts are most important because without them, the rest of this series has no meaning. The last 3 parts are dealing with Daniel 12:1 and the time of trouble. And those 3 parts, I am sure, have material in them that you have never seen before. So if you can possibly attend the last 3, do it. Make any effort you can to be here for the last 3. You need to see where this is going and why it's important. If the prophecy in Daniel 11 stopped in verse 45 and didn't continue, if there was no Daniel 12:1, Daniel chapter 11 would be completely irrelevant. It would have no meaning whatsoever. It's 12:1 that gives its meaning. But in order to understand the significance of 12:1, you've got to understand the history that leads up to it. And so that's what these other parts are going to be. So the first part tonight is dealing with Adventist history and what the pioneers taught. We're going to be showing it on slides. So I'm going to take the microphone to the back where I have the computer. And if I could get somebody to turn down the lights, we're going to get started. Oh, and by the way, there are programs on the table for anybody who wants a program for the times of the meetings. We also have some free handouts there. One of our handouts is available online for those of you who are listening online. The other one is not yet, but it will be. Let's begin with a word of prayer. Dear Father in heaven, we pray for your presence here to open our minds to understand the things that we haven't seen before. We pray for your help to think outside of the box, to be willing to accept truth, even if it goes directly against what we have heard and been taught all our lives. We pray for each one here, each one that is listening online, that you will be with them too, that you will help them to see and understand as we go through this material. And we thank you for hearing and answering our prayers. In Jesus' name, amen. So the picture we have here on the screen is the Hagia Sophia. This word means the Church of the Holy Wisdom. This building is located in Constantinople. Today it's called Istanbul, but for more than 1,000 years the city was called Constantinople because it was built by Constantine. This church was completed by the Roman Emperor Justinian in 537 AD. Now this is significant because Justinian was the one who issued the decree that made the Pope ruler of the West in 538 AD. This church was the largest Christian church for 1,000 years, the largest Christian church in the world for 1,000 years. It became a mosque in 1453, and it became a museum in 1931. Inside, it is 182 feet from the floor to the inside of that dome. It took them 5 years and 10 months to build it. It was designed and built by a mathematician and a physicist. And the interesting point about this is, according to James Arabido, the designers and builders of this building came from Syria, and they were Sabbath keepers, even though the Emperor Justinian was not. This building is so large, the inside of the building covers 4 acres. And there is a specific reason why we have used this as our backdrop. It's because this church, more than any other, is a symbol of the Ottoman Empire. The mosques of the Muslims, many of them were designed based on this structure. I'm sure most people don't realize that the Muslim mosques were, most of them, designed after a Christian church. But they were so impressed by the architecture of this building that they added the minarets to it, and then they took that design and copied it in their mosques. So tonight we're going to start with part one, setting the stage. This is setting the stage for all the rest of the series. So let's look at Daniel 12:1. And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince, and there shall be a time of trouble. This is the event, the time of trouble, that we are all looking for. This is the event we are all preparing for, or we're supposed to be preparing for it. By this time, the loud cry has been given, the latter rain has fallen. But what about that time of trouble? This is the question that this series of studies is going to look at. There have been several studies on the loud cry and latter rain, and we're going to proceed on with these studies on the time of trouble without further discussion on those two topics. In this first study, we're going to find out about the events described in scriptures, especially Daniel, leading up to this climax of Michael standing up and what others, especially the Adventist pioneers, have identified as the historical fulfillment of those prophecies. We pray that this does not confuse you, because determining who was right, if any were, is going to be dealt with later. Because you're going to find that they have some interesting concepts on this. We think this first study is necessary because of what we have been led to believe in the past. It is much like the Jews in Christ's day and their tradition he had to overcome. Therefore, we ask you to approach this subject with an open mind. Compare what we say with what the scriptures and the spirit of prophecy says, and set aside what you may have heard before that contradicts what you're going to see here today. For most of the prophecies in Daniel, there is little disagreement. But in the last part of Daniel 11, there's a lot of controversy. In order for us to understand this controversy, we need to quickly review the prophecies of chapter 2, 7, 8, and 9. And I don't have the pointer. Okay, we'll do without it. So the first thing you have here is Daniel 2 with the image. Then we have Daniel 7 and 8. We have the four beasts. We have the little horn. We have the ram and the he-goat. Most of that in Adventism is not disputed. And for most of my life, Daniel 11 was completely avoided. I didn't even know what was there. We also need to quickly review the first part of chapter 11, if that can be done. There is a lot going on in the chapter. Please note, chapter 10 is an introduction to chapter 11. Daniel chapter 2 is a prophecy in general of what would happen to the kingdom of Babylon, then in power until Christ's second coming, using an image of various metals. Chapter 7 goes over the same territory with more details, using beasts with odd characteristics. So it goes over the same ground, but adds some different ideas. Chapter 8 uses two beasts, a ram and a he-goat, to describe in even more detail the same events, but instead of starting with Babylon, it starts with Medo-Persia. And why is that? The reason why it starts with Medo-Persia is because when this vision was given, Babylon had already disappeared off the scene. It even puts in a timeline with a starting event. See Daniel 8:14. Chapter 9 adds more information to this timeline. So in this timeline, you have the 2300 days, you have the 70 weeks, and we're not going to go into discussing that now. If you want to look at this chart, it is posted on our website. Our website is www.inlightofprophecyfulfilled.org. And if you want to go there and look at these studies more closely, you are more than welcome to do so. And when this is done, we will type that into the room for you as well. Chapter 11 is different than the other chapters. It doesn't use symbols as were done in the three prophecies before. It calls the powers kings. It too starts with Persia and covers the same events as covered in the other prophecies, adding more detail. There are no times mentioned as there were in chapters 8 and 9, but we can safely assume that the events described happened pretty much in the sequence given. And what's interesting with chapter 11 is right at the beginning, the angel comes to talk to Daniel, and he says to Daniel, "I am now come to show thee the truth." And why does he do that? If you read chapter 10, Daniel had been praying. And he was praying something very specific. He was praying for understanding because he did not understand the visions he had received before. So this time the angel comes to him and he says, "I'm now going to tell you this in plain language. I'm not going to use symbols." That's really important to understand as we go through this. We have described a mighty king shall stand up and do according to his will in verse 3, whose kingdom was broken toward the four winds of heaven in verse 4. There is no disagreement that this was Alexander the Great of Greece. Even the evangelicals admit that. And the division of his kingdom to his four generals. I should say many of the evangelicals admit that. In the next verse, we have described the king of the south and the king of the north. We go back in history to the division of Alexander's empire and find that Ptolemy ruled the southern part. That leads us to place the four generals according to the points of the compass, east, west, north, and south. And on this map, you can see Ptolemy in the south, ruling Egypt, Seleucus in the east, Lysimachus in the north, and Cassander in the west. Now, what's interesting here is the fact that Daniel 11 deals with north and south. It doesn't deal with east and west, except here at the beginning. And why is that? Well, if you look at history, you find out why. It wasn't very many years after the four divisions when Lysimachus fought Cassander and conquered him. And Lysimachus took over all of Cassander's territory. Well, it wasn't very long after that when Seleucus went to war with Lysimachus, and Lysimachus lost, and Seleucus took over all of the northern territory and therefore became the king of the north. And the northern kingdom is always known as the Seleucid Empire because of the name Seleucus. The southern kingdom is known in history as the Ptolemaic Empire. This is important because through the rest of chapter 11, we have many references to the king of the north and south. In fact, the phrase king of the north only occurs 7 times in the KJV Bible. And they're all in Daniel 11, verses 6, 7, 8, 11, 13, 15, and 40. In verse 14, we introduce a new power, the robbers of thy people. This was Rome, who in 200 BC, beginning to exert its power, joined forces with the king of the south. Since Rome had joined forces with the king of the south, Rome could not have been the king of the north, as the king of the north was overcome by these joined forces. In verse 15, we have the last mention of the king of the north until verse 40. So you see, Rome is the purple up there on the Italian peninsula. That was early Rome, and then it just expanded. And you really need to notice the fact that Rome is never once called the king of the north in Daniel 11. Not even when it's introduced. When it's introduced into the prophecy, it's called the robbers of thy people. The reason this is important to understand is because there are historic Adventists today who claim that Rome is called the king of the north from the time it conquered the king of the north all the way through verse 40 and down to verse 45. This is not the case. And if you look at history, they tell us that these historic Adventists that I have listened to tell us that Rome conquered the king of the north, so it became the king of the north, and then it conquered all this other territory. But be careful. Look at history. What actually happened in history was Rome united with Egypt first before it conquered the king of the north. So if it united with Egypt first, why is it not the king of the south conquering the king of the north? But the fact is, the prophecy itself does not refer to Rome as the king of the north. Rome was out to the west. Rome was not the king of the north. That's really important to keep in mind. Also in verse 16, we see Rome called the one who shall do according to his own will. Notice that Alexander in verse 3 was described as doing according to his will. This is important because when we get to verse 36, we have another king that shall do according to his own will. However, in verse 16, the one who shall do according to his own will is not called a king. Unlike Babylon, Medo-Persia, and Greece, Rome did not have a king. It started as a republic. Those that were governed controlled those that governed. Rome started as a republic, not an empire. Yes, it became an empire, but it wasn't at first. From verse 16 through 35, we have the rise and fall of the Roman Empire, the destruction of Jerusalem, the scattering of the Jews, the persecution of the Christians, the rise of the papal power and the Dark Ages, until the time of the end in verse 35. The time of the end, we know, is 1798. You can see that in Revelation 11, 2 to 3, and Revelation 12, 6. From verse 36 to 40, we have described a new power. It could be Napoleon, his rise to power, and the French Revolution. Verse 40 is where the controversy really begins. Is the king of the north France, the papacy, the Ottoman Empire, Which is it? And what did the Adventist pioneers believe? Today, the majority believe that the King of the North in verses 40 to 45 is the papacy. But there are some who differ in their opinion and apply the prophecy to the Ottoman Empire or to modern Islam. But what is the correct view? This is an important question and deserves careful study, because the end of the King of the North signals the time of trouble and the most momentous events in the history of this world. Have you heard the statement that most of the leaders in the Millerite movement, including William Miller, believe that the King of the North is to be identified with the papacy? We believed it too, until we tried to find support from the writings of the pioneers. And when we did this study, we actually worked this backwards. We started from the time of trouble, and we worked backwards through the King of the North, and then we asked, what did the pioneers have to say? And the first studies we put together on this, we made this statement that William Miller taught that it was the papacy. And then when we decided to write a little more in depth on it, I decided I needed a quote from him, and I went looking. And were my eyes ever opened? I had no idea that this is what I was going to find. We found that James White, Otis Nichols, and Hiram Edson thought that the king who came to his end was the papacy, but no one else left any record of agreeing with them. Even James White doesn't give us any clear presentations of precisely how he interpreted this prophecy. In order for us to comprehend the positions that the pioneers took on verses 40 to 45, we need to examine the four verses before verse 40. In verse 36, we notice the king that shall do according to his will, or the willful king. And this is verse 36. And the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that is determined shall be done. In verse 37 through 39, we have this willful king referred to by the pronouns he, his, and himself. There's no other power mentioned, either new or old. Well, let's go ahead and read these three verses here. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall magnify himself above all. But in his estate shall he honor the God of forces, and a God whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and with precious stones and pleasant things. Thus shall he do in the most strong holds with a strange God, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many and shall divide the land for gain. We're obviously talking about the same power. This willful king power is going to do all of this. So in verse 40, we have three powers mentioned. The king of the north, the king of the south, the king of the north, and him. In the part of the verse shown, we have him twice. The first one that the king of the south pushes at must be the willful king mentioned before. The second him can be taken in two ways. It could be the willful king, or it could be the king of the south. If taken the second way, then the king of the north can be a new power, or it can be the willful king. The king of the north is the same as the willful king is a very popular belief today, but it wasn't always that way. So let's read the verse here. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him. Now who's him? Obviously the willful king. And the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind. So who's the second him? Two of these powers are clearly and easily identified. We've got the king of the north and the king of the south. But we also have the pronouns. Now remember your English lessons. A noun is a word that refers to a person, place, or thing, right? A pronoun is a word such as he or him that refers to a noun that was used previously. The word to which the pronoun refers is called the antecedent. The antecedent always comes before the pronoun that refers to it. For example, Sam went to town. He bought a shirt. Who went to town? It was Sam. And who bought the shirt? Well, it was obviously Sam that bought the shirt. You know Sam bought the shirt. Now let's turn this around. If you reverse this, you say, he went to town and Sam bought a shirt. Now you know Sam went to town, but who bought the shirt? You have no way of knowing because there's no antecedent to he. Okay? Now keep this in mind. The first pronoun we find in this verse is him. This is the power that the King of the South pushes at. The noun that him refers to must be the willful king. This is where things get a little bit confusing. Proper English grammar would dictate that the second him would refer to the same willful king power that the first him refers to. Thus, the King of the South shall push at the willful king, and the King of the North shall come against the willful king like a whirlwind. There are plainly three powers here. But current thought on this verse confuses the issue. Ignoring the correct grammatical structure of the verse, we're told that when the King of the North is brought into the picture, the verse is renaming the first him, or the willful king, thus the antecedent, the noun to which the pronoun refers, comes after the pronoun that refers to it. Now are you totally confused? Because I am. This is something we never do in English grammar. With this rendering, the verse reads, the King of the South shall push at the King of the North, and the King of the North shall come against him like a whirlwind. You can easily see that this drastically changes the meaning of the verse. Instead of three obvious players, there are now only two players, and the second him refers to the King of the South instead of the willful king, who is eliminated completely by confusing his identity with that of the King of the North. This grammatical structure of verse 40 is essential to keep in mind when we consider the positions taken on this subject by the pioneers. To them, it was plain. To them, it was clear. There are three powers here. Today, in Adventism, it's no longer clear. We now need to read quickly Daniel 11:40-45. So we can have some background to understand what these pioneers wrote. Quotes they used are highlighted. Also, all the pronouns referring to the King of the North are highlighted. So Daniel 11:40-42, and at the time of the end shall the King of the South push at him, and the King of the North shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. And verses 43-45. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. And the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. And he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end and none shall help him. All of this leads up to verse 45. This power, this King of the North, comes to his end. William Miller did teach that the willful king of verses 36-39 was the papacy. But when he got to verse 40, he had this to say, and this is a direct quote from one of his lectures. We therefore begin at the 40th verse of the 11th chapter of Daniel. And at the time of the end of this papal civil power, now another person has obtained this civil power, and this was Bonaparte, or Napoleon, the ruler of the French nation. At this time, then, our prophecy begins, and Bonaparte is the person designated by the pronouns he and him in the prophecy. Now, that's an interesting twist after what we just discussed about pronouns. And it's definitely not making the papacy the king of the north. He goes on to show that the prophecy is perfectly fulfilled by Napoleon and that he came to his end with none to help him in 1815. Now, we need to remember that the Adventist pioneers originally believed that the end of the world was going to be in 1844. They were thinking that the cleansing of the sanctuary was the cleansing of the world by fire at Christ's second coming. So this is the reason why they chose Napoleon to be the king of the north, because they were trying to squeeze in all fulfillments of prophecy before 1844. In order to accomplish this, though, they had to violate some of their own prophetic principles of interpretation. Namely, that the glorious holy mountain was Rome, and that the glorious land was Italy, which moves the original geographical positions of these places, which are really Jerusalem and Palestine. Remember, the angel Gabriel returned to explain the vision of Daniel 8 and 9 to him in the beginning of chapter 10 and said, "Now I come to make thee understand what shall befall thy people in the latter days." So the whole vision deals with this history without using symbols. To come to this conclusion, William Miller interprets the glorious land and between the seas to mean Italy. And here's another statement from Miller where he paraphrases the verse. "And at the time of the end of Antichrist, shall the king of the south, of Spain, push at France, the Vendean War, and the king of the north, Great Britain," now that's the twist, "shall come against France like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And the French, or Bonaparte, the principal ruler, shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over." Now, there's something you need to understand here, that most researchers I have found don't pick up on at all. William Miller did not believe it was the king of the north that came to his end in verse 45. William Miller believed it was the willful king that came to his end in verse 45. That you need to understand. Following the great disappointment, most Millerites simply gave up their beliefs. Some did not, and viewpoints and explanations proliferated. Miller initially seems to have thought that Christ's second coming was still going to take place, that the year of expectation was according to prophecy, but that there might be an error in Bible chronology, which was of human origin, that could throw the date off somewhat and account for the discrepancy. Miller never gave up his belief in the second coming of Christ. He died on December 20, 1849, still convinced that the second coming was imminent. Although he never accepted the Sabbath of the third angel's message, we are told by Ellen White that he was laid in the grave to be saved, because his friends blinded him to the Sabbath. An interesting side note to this is that William Miller, like many of his day and generation, was a Freemason. But he resigned his Masonic membership in 1831, stating that he did so to, quote, "avoid fellowship with any practice that may be incompatible with the word of God among Masons." And in 1833, he wrote in a letter to his friends to treat Freemasonry as they would any other evil. I found that quite interesting. When he accepted the truth, he got out of Freemasonry and saw it as an evil. This makes it even clearer that William Miller did not believe the king of the north to be the papacy. All he put it in there is Great Britain, as you saw. Joshua Himes paraphrases it the same way. Quotes, If this is correct, then France is intended by he or him in this prophecy. In order then to give my view, the reader will permit me to paraphrase these few remaining verses. And the time of the end of Antichrist shall the king of the south, Spain, push at France, the Vendean War, and the king of the north, Great Britain, shall come against France like a whirlwind with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And the French, or Bonaparte, the principal ruler, shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. Again, the king of the north does not come to his end in verse 45, according to Joshua Himes. Now, Himes is an interesting character. You've got two pictures of him there, one when he was a young man and one when he was an old man. Himes was a very popular and controversial minister of the First Christian Church in Boston. He was known for espousing radical causes, such as abolition and temperance. He accepted William Miller's preaching in 1839. He published the first Signs of the Times magazine in 1840. He did not accept the Midnight Cry with the October 22 date right away, but finally he did in August of 1844. After the disappointment, Himes joined the Albany Conference, which was the main body of Adventists that formed after the disappointment. They still believed Jesus was soon to come, but that they should not try to set a date. The leaders forming this organization included Miller, Himes, and Litch. He did not accept the Sabbath, but was instead among those whom Ellen White calls the First Day Adventists. In 1875, Himes joined the Episcopal Church. Just before his death, in 1895, he went for treatment to the Battle Creek Sanitarium. While there, he was a patient of Dr. Kress, and he had a conversation with John Loughborough. He told Kress that, quote, God accomplished the purpose of the message he gave to us, and when our work was done, the Seventh-day Adventists were raised up to carry the work forward to completion, in calling the people in all the world to move forward into the eternal land of promise, end quote. He told Loughborough that of one thing he was thankful, he had never opposed the work of Mrs. E.G. White. That was doubtless with remembrance of the fact that many of the First-day Adventists of the former movement had made the Spirit of Prophecy gift a special object of attack. So, interesting, Himes never accepted the Sabbath, but yet he recognized that the work of God was carried forward by the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Charles Fitch. Charles Fitch talked about the King of the North this way, after quoting Daniel 11:40-45. Here we have a most striking epitome of the history of Bonaparte. All that was here foretold was true of him, as history abundantly shows. He did plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in Italy, which we know is between two seas, and which has ever been the glorious holy mountain of the Romans. On the 15th of May, 1796, Bonaparte took possession of Milan in Italy, and at that place, on the 26th of May, 1805, he was crowned King of Italy. Thus he planted the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain of the Romans. But he came to his end on a solitary island, as we all know, and none helped him. All these predicted events, therefore, are now in the history of the past. Charles Fitch, we have no pictures of him as an old man because he died at the age of 39, just 8 days before October 22. He had become seriously ill after an extended baptism in freezing weather. But he wasn't concerned. He knew Jesus would raise him again in just a few days. His family was doubly disappointed on October 22. In her first vision, Ellen White mentions seeing Fitch in heaven after the second coming and conversing with him. And she also mentions that he was laid in the grave to save. And now we have Josiah Litch. Now, he is an interesting character. Josiah Litch handled the prophecy very differently. In regard to the willful king, he says, after quoting Daniel 11, 35 to 36, quotes, "Such a system as is here described was the French Revolution. It was founded in atheism and triumphed in the overthrow of everything which interposed a barrier to their object. The seed of this revolution were sown by Voltaire, the noted French infidel, who in early youth vowed to dedicate his life to the extermination of Christianity." Very interesting. Josiah Litch recognized that for the pronouns he and him in verse 40 to be referring to the willful king needed to be France. And so he brings in the French Revolution here. That's an important point to remember. And the reason that's important to remember is because most Adventists today are going to tell you that Uriah Smith invented this idea of France being the willful king. This was not a Uriah Smith invention. We see from this that Litch did not agree that the willful king was the papacy. When he got to verse 40, he explains it this way. "The king of the south shall push at him. At whom? The answer is at the subject of prophecy in the preceding verses. The revolutionary government of France. That power is clearly antecedent." Remember that word? An antecedent is the noun to which the pronoun refers. "That power is clearly antecedent to him in this verse. The king of the south," and who is the king of the south? The answer is given in the exposition of the first six verses of the chapter, which the reader can examine. It is clearly the government of Egypt. "I do not know that there is a dissenting voice to the application of this term to Egypt in the former part of this chapter, nor can I see any good reason why there should be in the latter part, as long as it was literally fulfilled in Egypt. That a collision did actually take place between the French and Egypt is notorious. Next came Saint Jean de Cur in Syria, the king of the north, which was to come against him like a whirlwind." So he put Syria as the king of the north. Very interesting. Now, Josiah Litch is another really interesting character of the Millerite movement. And these four that we've quoted from are the primary leaders of the movement. Josiah Litch was a Methodist who accepted the teachings of William Miller in 1838. Using the historicist interpretation methods of Miller and of most of the Protestants of his day, remember that, most Protestants in this time used the historicist method of interpretation. Litch predicted the removal of power from the Ottoman Empire on August 11, 1840, based on Revelation 9. When the Ottomans accepted the protection of the powers of Europe on that exact date, it gave great power to the Advent movement. And this is mentioned in the Great Controversy. Litch also introduced the idea that the judgment occurs before the Second Advent. This was later developed by the SDAs into the Investigative Judgment Doctrine. So Litch is the actual one who introduced this concept to Adventists. But after the disappointment, Litch rejected the Sabbath and joined the First Day Adventists. He then completely abandoned the historicist method of interpretation and adopted futurism, the method that the evangelical churches of America adopted. And why did they adopt the futurist method? Because it was the only way they could counteract Adventism. Because the Adventists had it right if they followed historicist methods. And the rest of the evangelicals didn't want to accept Adventist doctrine, so they had to come up with a different method, and they went to futurism, and Litch went with them. The futurist method is the one used to come up with the seven-year tribulation concept that is espoused by most evangelicals today. And by the way, it was invented by a Jesuit. And we'll deal with that some more in a later study. Litch goes on to show that the rest of the prophecy is fulfilled by Napoleon, who came to his end in 1815. Now I want you to notice something here. We're living in 2015. William Miller and his associates were living and preaching in 1840 to 44, or 1833 to 1844. They were closer in time to Napoleon's end and the Napoleonic Wars of Europe and the French Revolution than we are today to World War II. That's how recent the history was to them. Napoleon is not ancient history. Napoleon is modern history. And for the Adventists, it was extremely modern history. Of the leaders of the Advent movement prior to 1844, we've only been able to locate statements on the King of the North by Miller, Himes, Fitch, and Litch. They all agree that the power that came to its end in verse 45 was Napoleon. But they don't all agree on who the King of the North was. It seems that most of the prominent Millerites believed that the willful king and the king of the north were two different powers, and that the power that came to its end was Napoleon. Now let's move on. It's important to understand this, because those who claim that the pioneers taught that the king of the north was the papacy, is the papacy, always identify the willful king and the king of the north as the same power. They look at what Miller and other pioneers said about the willful king and assume that they also considered these terms to refer to the same power when they did not. This is a misrepresentation of the facts. Not only did none of them say that the king of the north was the papacy, but they didn't think that the king of the north came to his end in verse 45. And all of them saw three powers in verse 40, not two. But what about James White? Wasn't he the exception? Let's take a look. In 1847, this is 3 years after the disappointment, James White printed a booklet that included articles by him, Ellen White, and Joseph Bates. In the article he wrote, entitled The Time of Trouble, he makes this statement, quotes, "But as I cannot harmonize either of these views," speaking of two views of when Michael stands up, "with the Bible, I wish to humbly give my brethren and sisters my view of these events." Michael is to stand up at the time that the last power in chapter 11 comes to his end and none to help him. This power is the last that treads down the true church of God. And as the true church is still trodden down and cast out by all Christendom, it follows that the last oppressive power has not come to his end, and Michael has not stood up. This last power that treads down the saints is brought to view in Revelation 13, 11 to 18, and his number is 666. We know who that is. This statement is taken by some to mean that James White, Ellen White, and Joseph Bates agreed that the King of the North was the papacy. Well, I think that's stretching it a bit. When James White is presenting it as my view, he's basically saying, here you go, here's what I think. He didn't say, here's what we think. He said, here's what I think. This is my personal view on this. That doesn't mean the rest of them agree. It is thought that because 6 pages of this book were written by Sister White, that she had to have agreed with her husband's view of things. But she published many articles in the review, and this is never taken to mean that she agreed with all the views of everyone else who published articles in the same review. And the same could be said of Joseph Bates. Just the fact that he wrote part of the book does not mean he wholeheartedly agreed with James White's personal view. It doesn't mean he disagreed with it either. We just have to leave Joseph Bates and Ellen White out of the equation because we've been unable to find anything that either of them wrote as to who they think the King of the North represents. So we know what James White thinks. But please notice that James White did not say the papacy is the King of the North, which is the last oppressive power. He says that the papacy is the power that comes to his end. In fact, in the December 12, 1854 issue of the Review and Herald, he quotes the following from the Bible Examiner. "We do not believe, hold on. We do do not believe that Russia is the king of the north. It is our opinion that any power that reigns over Syria, for the time being, the king of the north, spoken of in Daniel 11. Hence that the Turkish dynasty, yes, the Turkish dynasty is now that power. No arguments nor ridicule that has yet appeared has in the least shaken our mind. Yet we do not affirm that we are right. Events may convince us that we are wrong in this matter. We have no theory at stake and shall feel, we think, no mortification to find we are, just what we believe all others to be, fallible. Now that's the statement James White quoted. The king of the north is the Turkish dynasty. James White makes no qualifying statement either before or after this quote to indicate that he or the denomination does not agree with this view. And as editor, he surely must have had something to do with including that quote in the paper. But we find another interesting statement in the sounding of the seven trumpets of Revelation 8 and 9, published in 1859. And now this is a book that James White wrote. There is scarcely so uniform an agreement among interpreters concerning any part of the apocalypse as respecting the application of the fifth and sixth trumpets, or the first and second woe, to the Saracens and the Turks. And the close coincidence, or rather express identity, between the king of the south and or the king of the north, as described by Daniel, and the first and second woe will be noted in the subsequent illustration of the latter. Interesting quote. Again, these are not words from the pen of James White himself. He is quoting a passage from Keith, another Bible commentator. It would, however, have been a very simple thing for him to leave out this portion of the passage if he did not agree with it. It adds little to the exposition he is making of the seven trumpets, but he left it in and again makes no qualifying statement about it. This leads us to the startling conclusion that James White may have believed that the king of the north was Turkey, even though he clearly believed that the power which comes to its end is the papacy. But there are also other articles in the Review on this topic. In 1853, Otis Nichols published an article in the Review and Herald entitled The Papacy in France. In this article, he presents the view that the King of the North is England and the King of the South is a coalition of the French and the papacy. Oh, the King of the South is the papacy? That's a switch. Here again, we see the idea that the King of the North and the willful king are two separate powers. He closely follows Miller's reasoning, but says verse 45 is unfulfilled. In 1856, Hiram Edson wrote an article entitled The Times of the Gentiles, in which he discusses the reasons why the United States is the glorious land of Daniel 11. You know, we've got ideas all over the place that these guys are writing about. Everybody has a different idea. And today we've been told all our lives that they all agreed that the king of the north was the papacy. I can't find the agreement. It seems that James White agreed with Edson on this point because he brings it out 21 years later in a review article in 1877. But Edson does not elaborate on the king of the north except to say this. Verses 36 to 39 contain a catalog of the acts and doings of the papal king. And verse 40 foretells an event which shall mark the time of the end, where the indignation would cease. And at the time of the end, the king of the south shall push at him. He also foretells that the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind and gives a prophetic history of his campaign, at which time Michael would stand up, and there or then should be a time of trouble such as never was. He obviously puts verses 40 to 45 in the future, the same as James White apparently does. So we've switched now. Miller and his people were putting it in the past, and now the Seventh-day Adventists are putting it in the future. We've read and cataloged every Review and Herald, and every Signs of the Times article available on the General Conference Archives website in which the phrase King of the North appears, as well as numerous other church periodicals and writings by the pioneers. And I personally did this. And I have on my computer every single article in PDF form that I could find in the review and the signs that has the phrase King of the North in it. If you want any of them, let me know. Based on what others were writing at the time, we could easily conclude that James White was looking for two opposing powers, one from the south and one from the north, to attack the papacy and lead to its demise. But lacking any definite word from him on this, we would be better to leave the poor man in peace and not try to force him to support any position on the interpretation of these verses. Here is the results of the cataloging we did. This is a picture of our paper that we came up with when we did this cataloging. The following chart was put together after doing this search on the King of the North. After the meeting, on the table over by the door, we have this chart as a handout for free. For anybody who wants to take it, go ahead, take the chart, and look at it. We've got every single thing we found in that chart with the reference and the date, and you can take it, and you can go on the General Conference archives, and you can actually get those articles and read them. So be sure to pick that up. For those online, it is on our website. If you go to our studies page, go to our Caught Unprepared link. Right underneath the Caught Unprepared Part 1 is a link to the chart. It says, I forget what it's called, but it's right underneath Part 1. So you can go download it in PDF and take a look at this. And here's another page from the chart. You can see Joshua Himes. We had the papacy. Great Britain and Napoleon are the three powers talked about. And we've got Charles Fitch, Josiah Litch, James White, and so on, all the ones that we have gone through. So now we're going to go through a few of these and take a look at the position they took. So we have first, we have William Miller. The date of the quote we have is 1833. He said, the willful king was the papacy, the king of the north was Great Britain, and the king that comes to his end is Napoleon. The next one we have is Joshua Himes, 1841. The willful king is the papacy, the king of the north, Great Britain, the king that comes to his end, Napoleon. We have Charles Fitch, 1842. The willful king is the papacy. He doesn't clearly state who the king of the north is, but the king that comes to his end is Napoleon. Josiah Litch, the willful king is France, the king of the north, Syria, or the Ottoman Empire. The king that comes to his end, Napoleon. James White, he doesn't tell us what he thinks the willful king is. There's a possibility that he thinks the king of the north is the Ottoman Empire, but definitely the king that comes to his end is the papacy. E.R. Seaman, I actually do not know who E.R. Seaman was, but he wrote an article in the Review in 1853. The willful king, he's not clear on, but he clearly states that the king of the north is Russia. And he doesn't say who it is that comes to his end. But that was published in 1853 in the Review. Otis Nichols, another article in 1853. The willful king is the papacy, the king of the north, Great Britain. The king that comes to his end is the papacy. Hiram Edson, 1856, the willful king is the papacy, the king of the north, he doesn't say, it's not clear. The king that comes to his end is the papacy. Uriah Smith, 1862, the willful king, he's not clear. King of the north doesn't say anything about it. But he seems to indicate that the king that comes to his end is the papacy, and this is simply a one-sentence statement from Uriah Smith in 1862. It's one sentence. But it is used, that one sentence is used by certain Adventists today to say that Uriah Smith believed that the King of the North was the papacy and he reversed his view. So that's why we have it in here. John Loughborough, 1869, he said the willful king was the papacy and France. King of the North was Great Britain, but he doesn't indicate who comes to his end. Not a single one of the pioneers from 1840 to 1870 say that the King of the North was the papacy. Of the 11 references we found, that's not very many, there's just 11. Four of them say it was Great Britain. Two say that it was Syria, the Ottoman Empire or Turkey in their day. One says that it is Russia, and the rest are unclear. As for who comes to his end in verse 45, four say that it was Napoleon Bonaparte, three say that it is the papacy, and the rest are unclear. The willful king is the only one that seems to have any kind of unanimity. But even on this, the opinions are far from unanimous. Six say that he is the papacy, and one says that he is France. The rest are unclear. This leaves us with the surprising conclusion that the majority view of the Advent pioneers was that the King of the North was Great Britain, the king who comes to his end in verse 45 was Napoleon, and the willful king was the papacy. The only point on which we can truly claim a unanimous opinion among the pioneers is the fact that the grammar of verse 40 requires three powers to be in conflict.